Welcome to New Realities. My name is Alan Steinfeld, and if you've been listening to this program over the last few years, you know it's about a transformation that's happening in the consciousness of our culture and in the world. And tonight we'll be addressing one of the subjects that I feel is really key to understanding transformation in general and how that has taken place in cultures around the world. It's this topic of alchemy, and I'll be talking to Teresa Ibis and Dennis William Houck, and they're putting on the Alchemy Conference that's happening at the Los Angeles Convention Center October 23rd to the 25th, and you can look up their website, alchemyconference.com. I'm on the phone right now with Teresa Ibis, who's a physicist, and we're going to talk about the way alchemy and physics really merged together. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, Alan.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Yes,
I mean, the name of the show is New Realities because I feel like we are opening up to a new way of understanding things like alchemy. It's no longer something that's been pushed away. It doesn't have to be hidden. It can be out in the open. And can you talk about then the way quantum physics is another expression of alchemy, in a sense?
Yeah, let's just dive in.
Yes.
Well, you know, as we have been becoming more and more aware of the possibilities that quantum physics is presenting us with as a whole new paradigm and a whole new way of looking at this world and this universe that we live in, people's consciousness and people's awareness has been shifting to, wow, you know, maybe my view as an observer of this and as a participant in this world does make a difference. You know, maybe it's not just a mechanistic, deterministic world that we live in. Like, our consciousness has a role to play. And so people are really starting to open up to this idea. Well, it turns out that the ancient science and art that alchemy is, which has been on the planet for thousands of years, has always had this view. They have always said our consciousness is an integral piece of the equation, that the observer and the observed, or in the alchemical way of talking about it, they would say that the alchemist and their object or their experiment are intimately connected and entangled, and you can't separate them. That the state of mind of the alchemist has all this influence at a subtle level on the results that they're going to see in the world.
So the aspect of quantum physics that you're really saying that applies to consciousness is that the observer does affect the experiment. Is that
absolutely? And there's step one, which is the sighting of the observer effect, which is a really important piece of quantum mechanics. But
can you actually explain, what experiments have shown that to be absolutely true?
Well, it's not quite that simple. So you have, for example, it really depends on how the scientist decides to set up their experiment. Mm-hmm. When it comes to quantum mechanics, it says that reality can either be seen as a particle, a solid matter, or as a waveform, as energy. And so they talk about this wave-particle duality. And whether we see something as a particle or we see it as a wave, it really depends on how we choose to observe it. So, for example, there have been scientific experiments that were looking at electrons. And usually it's like a double slit experiment. If you were to poke two holes in a screen and then shine particles through that, you know, you would think that particle would choose to go either through one hole or the other, because a particle is supposed to be point-like. But what they found was they would actually get an interference pattern saying that, no, that particle wasn't coming through as a particle. It was coming through as a wave of energy that really was very similar to what it would look like if light, which we know to be a wave, were shining through that double slit experiment. But then they can also do experiments with light where they would expect to see it showing up as a wave of energy, and then they would find out, no, it's a particle. That they can get single counts of photons, they call them. And so it really has to do with how the experimenter chooses to set up their experiment. So from the beginning, they determine the state.
I see. So that's the first part, is that there's a change in the effects of the reality of the experiment because of the observer. And they said there was another part to this understanding of quantum physics.
Well, there's many people these days who are using quantum mechanics and citing quantum mechanics for being one way that we can start to bridge this realm of consciousness and spirituality into science, right? So we have the Tao of physics, and we have what the bleep do we know, and we have these people who are saying, you know, it really is about your consciousness, and that's true. You have The Secret and the Law of Attraction and all these things that are really becoming these new paradigms right now for people to see how they believe and what they choose to focus on is going to determine the reality that they experience. But things like the Law of Attraction and the Power of Intention is really just step one. There are many, many more steps to getting from the power of your consciousness to the final result, and getting that final result to match the ideal vision or to match the highest potential that it could have.
Well, let's go. What are some of these other steps? Because I always thought there was more to it than just... intention is important.
Yes, intention is very important, but there's a process, and this is exactly where the deeper teachings of alchemy come in. In alchemy, they talk about there being seven steps to the process of transformation, or from changing one thing into another thing, or from taking something that is at a level that has impurities or imbalances or whatever, and transforming it into something that is more perfected. And so they talk about there being at least seven steps, which go through a couple different phases to get from that place of,
Oh, that's right. There's sublimation. There's all these things where, and then after
calcination and dissolution.
Right.
Yeah. And there's these big terms, but in reality, we all go through this process naturally. We're just usually not aware of it. And alchemy has over time has studied that natural process, and they've come to say, okay, well, this is the pattern. We see this pattern repeated so many different times and, in different ways and in different situations, but it's always the same pattern. And when we understand that pattern and we become conscious and aware of that and what those steps are, then we can step in as a more active participant to elicit that transformation process along and, indeed, to speed it up by engaging our own consciousness, our own will, and our own ability to create in the world and to work with nature to accelerate evolution rather than to just sort of be at the effect, or rather than to not be really conscious of what's going on. So that's really what alchemy is all about.
The alchemy, then, you're saying, and I have studied it, and is the way to use the world to evolve our own mind, our own awareness. So we're using nature to become more aware of who we are as a spiritual entity, would you say?
I think it works both ways. Alchemy has many different forms that it has taken on. There's the inner alchemy, which is kind of what you're talking about right now, which is how can we transform on the inner planes, and how can we use our outer world as a tool for creating those inner transformations, as well as other things that we can create just within our own self to elicit the transformation and to perfect our mind and perfect our own consciousness and our body and all of these things.
But right, that's inner alchemy. The outer alchemy, where we turn lead into gold. Is that what you're...
Right, where we turn lead into gold. Is lead into gold, some people can take that in a literal way, and but typically it's more a metaphorical process of lead being the density or the impurities or the toxins that arise in something that is in a raw state, and gold being a perfected state. And so the outer alchemy or the practical alchemy is to learn how to transform something in nature or in the world, in the outer world, by taking it through the various stages and by also harnessing subtle energies to really create like a synergy that takes it beyond what its natural state is.
Well, what kind of things are you talking about in the outer world?
Well, there's, for example, we could take an herb, and we can go and gather some herbs from nature, and we would start with them in their raw plant form, and then we would perform various processes on those herbs, and we would transform it into a very powerful elixir or tincture that can be taken internally to create healing in the body, to detoxify the body, or to create heightened spiritual awareness, or, you know, there's basically, depending on how you take it through the process and which herbs you start with, it will have a different effect. And this is actually the origins of modern pharmacology. But in modern pharmacology, they've diverged away from harnessing the subtle energies and recognizing the wholeness of the plant itself, and they've just tried to isolate different parts out, and they've lost all the life energy that harnesses.
That was called the lesser work or the minor work, from what I've studied.
Plant alchemy.
Plant alchemy.
Lesser work. And you can do the same in the greater work. They would work with minerals and metals, and again, take raw material through the various stages of transformation to create a really healing elixir, again, or stone. And so typically it's taking something from its raw state into a more perfected state. But there's not just that, right? We can take alchemy and we can apply it to the same pattern. You can apply it to relationships and how to perfect relationships. You can apply it to society. You can apply it to, you know, our economic, any kind of system or structure or organization or business that we have out there. We can take the same pattern and the same awareness and apply it to that particular system to perfect it to the next level.
Right. Someone showed it as an aspect of creativity, these seven levels that exist in alchemy. But I am interested in the fact that there were alchemists that were really trying, and maybe we'll talk to Dennis about that, that were really attempting to transform metal into gold. But through that, the process of transforming themselves, you see, like what you said in the beginning, it's a state of mind. So in the process of this chemical and alchemical transmutation, something happened to the observer in that attempt. And that was what was really called the great work, I feel. The transformation of oneself through the process of burning and cooking and burying these metals with all these concoctions at certain times of the year and certain times of day. And something happened to someone who was so focused in that that their consciousness shifted to a higher level.
Right. Well, it's similar to, again, it's that entanglement. Like, number one, the alchemist sees that their consciousness and their state of mind and emotion has an impact on the object that they're working on, But likewise, if it is intimately, if they're not separate, if they're entangled together, they're one and the same thing, whatever mm-hmm. operation the alchemist performs on that object, he's performing it on himself too. And
right.
so, yeah, like just like you said, if they burn, you know, this plant to crisp, for example, it's like they're burning themselves. And they create by the awareness that they are not separate from mm-hmm. what they are working on, they create this intimacy with their experiment, with their object. And, you know, in the end, the object is themselves. So it becomes mm-hmm. this sort of symbiotic relationship, this interconnected dynamic between the observer and the observed.
So, I appreciate that, and that's a great understanding, and I think that really opens people's minds to the power of alchemy, because I think there were true alchemists that were really going for the major work, and because they were entangled and having made or transformed something into gold, that gold lifted that person to a higher spiritual awareness. This mm-hmm. is what I get from
yeah.
the books I've read.
Absolutely. And it's so spiritualized that just like one drop of an elixir, for example, will just kind of send your consciousness into an altered state.
Have you had those elixirs?
I've had some of the herbal elixirs, and I've created some of the herbal elixirs. I haven't gotten into working with the metals or the minerals yet, but I have heard stories of, you know, real transmutations of lead, even lead into gold, that have happened more so in India and in the East, because in the East there's far more transparency. There is never a need to hide or veil the alchemical work because it was just more open and accepted in their spiritual traditions out there. Whereas in the Western society, there was a lot of fear that got created around the religious organizations and the work that the alchemists were doing. And so then they ended up having to hide and create a lot of obscurity around their work just to protect themselves and the power of that knowledge.
I know, it's too bad, because there were great schools of alchemy in Prague and all through the Middle Ages. Have you read the book The Red Lion?
Mm-mm, not that particular.
Oh, that's an amazing book about the history of alchemy in the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
And it's about an initiate who starts from a very low level of consciousness but is obsessed with this alchemical formula, and you trace his development through lifetimes until he becomes the Magnus, you know, the great magician.
Wow.
And
sounds like a good one.
It's a great overview. So, but what then do you feel is the ultimate goal of the alchemy? I mean, what do you want as an alchemist? What would you like to achieve?
Well, I would like to see, number one, a revival of alchemy in modern thought. I think that we're on the verge of that. And I think that with the tools and the awareness and the knowledge and understanding that alchemy can bring to people, we can finally start to take those steps to, at a much more practical level, bridge our modern scientific and technological way of working with the spiritual and consciousness movement so that we can take it out of the theory realm and into practicality and applicability in many of our societies. So I think that, you know, alchemy, one thing that happens is that throughout history you can look and see that there's something that they call the underground river or stream, where there's this body of knowledge and tools and understanding and wisdom that has flowed through history. And sometimes it's underground and it's submerged, and other times it comes up to the surface for anybody mm-hmm. to be able to partake of that wisdom. And when you look at that throughout history, those times when that knowledge, and that includes stuff like alchemy and Kabbalah and different, you know, metaphysics and initiations mm-hmm. and mystery school traditions, when they surface, we enter into a time of like a renaissance period mm-hmm. or a golden age or an age of enlightenment. And whenever mm-hmm. they submerge and go underground again, we enter into a time of like darkness and suppression or just ignorance. And so these things are coming out again, and it is like we're right at the precipice of a great shift into the next age of enlightenment or age of you know, next great forward leap in consciousness. But I think that it has to take place also at a real practical level within our systems and within our whole paradigm of how we're approaching life. So I really think that alchemy can help us with that.
Well, that's why I think your conference is so exciting. I just interviewed recently Nassim Harmin and his understanding of black holes and the transfer and the unification of physics, quantum physics, and Einstein's relativity. I mean, he has some real solid answers. And have you met him? Have you talked to him?
I have not, but I am very excited to have him speaking at the conference and to directly hear about his theories.
Oh, he is truly a genius. I could see him. I mean, if he can do what he says he can do with black hole technology, I think it'll change life on planet Earth, you know?
Yeah. The little bit that I've read of some of his work, I definitely think that he's onto something, and I'm very excited to hear some more about it. So, yeah, we have a fantastic lineup of speakers for the Alchemy Conference, and that is, you know, really the goal is to bring that awareness and to show people and to reintroduce alchemy to the modern world in a way that they see, like, there are so many different ways that alchemy is already being applied to help us transform and take that next great leap in our paradigms and in our ways of interacting with each other and in the ways that we're setting up our systems and our structures in this world and so forth. And we have people like scientists like Nassim and Don Estes and myself, and we have Dr. Emoto coming. And then we also have more of the spiritual alchemists like Don Miguel Ruiz, the author of The Four Agreements.
Oh, right. I just talked to him recently. Yes, he's a beautiful guy.
Yeah, with his Toltec teachings. And then we have Montauk Chia, who's bringing in the Taoist inner alchemy teachings.
That is a beautiful, the male, female, the fire and water. It's very alchemical. Actually, that's something I also wanted to address, the fact that alchemy can be applied to the body and to health, and the fact that our bodies are alchemical furnaces. We're always transmuting in our bodies, I feel, one element into another.
Yeah.
And that's not recognized by science.
Wow, well... I mean, yeah, they in science, they just make it this kind of biochemical machine, right? Whereas when you really look at it, it's like, okay, you might be able to talk about some of it in terms of biochemistry, but there's a whole energetics that happens to it as well. I mean, the quality of the food you eat is not just about, you know, the material that's in it. It's also about the energy that went into preparing that food, for example.
Right.
And, you know, your own state of mind when you consume the food. And, I mean, there's all these energetics that go into it. And then the things that we expose ourselves to is we're in a very toxic environment these days.
Mm-hmm.
And alchemy is very much about giving us remedies for eliminating those toxins out of the body and taking us into a more enlightened state, not just mentally and spiritually, but physically as well, so that the physical body can fully integrate and utilize the energies that it has at its disposal without being bogged down by all the toxins and all of the, you know, the bad stuff we might consume.
Well, I want to ask you a question. As a physicist, do you feel that we and the Earth are moving to a higher frequency, a higher vibration through evolution?
I think that there's a lot of evidence for that, that there is, for example, just looking at the vibrational energy of the Earth itself and the magnetic field of the Earth, its vibrational frequency is increasing. It's called the Schumann resonance, and it's been increasing and fluctuating a lot lately, and it's going to a higher vibrational state. You also see stuff, for example, in brainwave mapping of people, that especially in some of the younger generations now, we're starting to reach into brainwave frequencies in much higher range that they're calling gamma waves, that were never really seen before the 80s, and now all of a sudden they're being seen consistently within the brain.
What does that mean, though, that we're seeing within
the
children?
The gamma frequencies, they have shown that the people who are of older generations that are able to manifest these brainwave frequencies in the gamma are like the meditators from the Dalai Lama, for example, going into the compassion meditation. And when they move into that place of a unified mind and heart and are sending out this vibration of compassion, that's when they read these higher frequencies in their brainwaves mapping. But some of the kids who are coming through today just naturally have that. It's like this unified mind-heart where we've been operating with it so separate. You know, the mind and the emotions have been separated from the logic and the reason and the functioning of the mind, at least in the Western society, whereas we're now moving into a time where it's like, no, it's not about separating that anymore. It's about uniting and letting the heart guide our thoughts and guide our mind and, you know, move more into compassionate action in the world. And, gosh, if everybody was in compassionate action in this world, we would...
We'd have a beautiful world.
Exactly.
But it seems like as you're talking, I'm getting the feeling like a lot of things seem to be lining up. So the human resonance of the earth is increasing, and people are opening up brainwaves to higher states, higher frequencies, and the sun itself is coming into alignment with the galactic century, you know, the whole 2012 thing. And we're being prepared for a great shift where we actually have been in an alchemical process as a civilization, it seems like. Right? So we're about to emerge from that calcified state or whatever state and stage of alchemy we're in to awaken, I think, to a whole new humanity.
Yeah. I think personally that we've been at the, we've been going through many of this, you know, there's cycles within cycles in that,
right,
alchemical process. And, you know, in some ways we're all like, I think just about everybody I've talked to has really noticed how time is speeding up and how what we're putting out there is coming back really fast. And it's almost like there's this karmic cleansing happening right now. Cleansing the karma from our ancestors and from our, you know, forefathers and how our society's been set up. And it's just everything is kind of being purged at the moment. It's creating what seems like a crisis, but it's really a healing crisis. And, you know, great chaos precedes great growth sometimes. And I think we're at that moment of, in some ways, it's like the dark night of the soul for humanity, where it's really the fermentation stage. Like, we're in a maturing, but there's the final death needs to happen of these pieces of our society and our way of life on this earth that are not working. They need to die in order for us to leap up to that next, more refined state of how we're going to operate in the world and with each other. And so I think that we're beyond calcination and we're kind of in the next death phase.
Well, and they are dying, the economic system, political systems. I think they are in their last throes, and they are dissolving and changing. They can't exist in the same way that they have existed.
Exactly.
So we are seeing, but you talk more like a mystic than a physicist. You
know? Yeah, I'm a mystic by nature and a physicist by vocation and training.
But how do you translate what you've just said as far as the spiritual awareness into physics, into solids? How do you talk to your physicist friends about these things, or do you not?
You know, that's the challenge. A lot of the today's scientists and, you know, especially in mainstream science, they're not really interested in things that fall outside of the realm of hardcore experimental testability. And if you can't test it, prove it, then, you know, it doesn't belong in science is kind of how they view things. And so And then there's also a culture. There's a culture that was set up in science that really kind of shut the door on any kind of spiritual conversations.
Mm.
And so if
what was that culture? What did those scientists believe to be true to shut the door?
I think it was political. I think it came, you know, goes back to maybe the time when there was a lot of struggles happening between the religious power structure being threatened by scientific advancement during that Age of Enlightenment. There was a separation that happened where the scientists said, we see that there's a way to have deeper understanding of how nature works and how the world works, and we want to investigate that, and we want to have autonomy and freedom and independence to be able to do that without having the doctrine of religion trying to shut us up. And so they created a separation there to kind of let spiritual matters be, you know, in the hands of the church, but we want to have an understanding of the world. And they kind of had to create that separation in order to get their freedom.
Just as you're saying, I'm thinking alchemy is somewhere between those two things, because it is a spiritual practice, but it's also very much a science.
Exactly, exactly. And this is why I personally am so driven to help bring alchemy back out to the world, because it is exactly the place where we can walk the middle ground again, where we can walk that middle path and bridge between the practical and the hardcore science, laboratory work and all of it, and yet still have an awareness of consciousness and subtle energy and spirituality and you know, the more divine side of life, and bring the two together to meet in the middle.
Well, I totally agree. I mean, because I've always been fascinated and drawn to alchemy. I always knew it was a truth. I always knew that there's something that can be changed into something else, because it's everywhere around us all the time. And every day, every minute, in our bodies, in our minds, in the world.
In our bodies, in the stars, in the inside the earth, it happens everywhere.
Well, sure, that's the only reason there are all these elements, because alchemical transformations have happened.
Exactly.
I mean, hydrogen became everything, if you want to look at it from that point of view. Well, so why don't we get Dennis William Houck on the line, and why don't you just tell people a little bit about him, and maybe Seth can get him on the line. Yes.
Okay, great. Well, Dennis is one of my favorite alchemists. He actually, he's the author of one of the first books I read on alchemy that just turned me on to this whole field, coming from, you know, more science and having a spiritual background. And when I read his book on the Emerald Tablets, it was like a whole new world opened up to me. And he's just a very gifted writer and author, and has been able to present alchemy, its history, and how we can apply it internally and at a personal level to create those transformations within. He's been able to really write just some fantastic books that the layperson can understand and really get a much clearer sense of what alchemy is about.
When I first
learned about or heard about alchemy, I had the, you know, impression of alchemy is just about turning, you know, pseudoscientists of the Middle Ages trying to turn lead into gold. And I wanted nothing to do with it as a scientist. But then when I read Dennis's book, his first one that turned me on, I realized, like, no, that's not what alchemy is at all. I mean, it's this amazing understanding of how transformation happens and how we can apply that both within ourselves and in our world. And so,
right. Well, is he on? Dennis, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Thanks for joining us here. I have Teresa with us, and together you're created this conference, this alchemy conference that's happening in Los Angeles, October, 23rd to the 25th. But I'm interested in what you have to say about the origins of alchemy, especially the Emerald Tablets, which seems like the very beginning of the alchemical tradition. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. The Emerald Tablets carry a synopsis of the philosophy behind alchemy, that there is kind of a vertical axis of reality that's related above and below, or heaven and earth, however you want to look at it, that spirit or energy is coalesced into the world as we know it. It's very similar to quantum mechanics. I'm sure Therese has been talking about that, with the view that energy condenses into matter in that relationship. So the alchemists early on had this idea of energy. They called it by different names, sulfur, most usually because of the fiery characteristics of sulfur and the energetic properties of sulfuric acid and ideas like that. So they didn't use our terms, but they knew these ideas centuries before we came to discover them ourselves, and that has been attributed by nearly every alchemist down through the ages to the Emerald Tablet and the wisdom and the secret formula, the chemical formula that's contained in it, the spiritual formula that's contained in it, and it's an amazing document as far as being a synthesis of what alchemy is about.
Right, but I mean, when I've read the Emerald Tablets, and I have a copy of it, maybe it's your copy, but there's a sort of a mystery to it. They say there's this element that's very common, that I think it says poor people have more of an abundance of it than rich people. I mean, it's a sort of, what is this key, what is the philosopher's stone that you feel? What is that key ingredient that the Emerald Tablets refer to that it seems like a mystery?
I think that key ingredient is consciousness. The alchemists viewed consciousness as a force in nature, and they believed it could be added to the experiments and added to the transformations in order to guide it. But it was kind of the idea that we have nowadays about focusing the light of consciousness to create things, and that's been presented in a lot of different mystery traditions. But I think that's the basic key.
I'm interested in what you're saying about you know, consciousness being that key ingredient that the Emerald Tablets refers to.
It is the idea of using a purified state of consciousness to condense that energy or that light of consciousness, to use it to focus the energy. In other words, the alchemists believed thousands of years ago, all the way back to ancient Egypt, that there was a connection between our mind and reality, and how reality condenses around us. It's not that in some traditions you see this silly notion that, you know, your thoughts become real just by thinking them over and over again. And that's not the idea, really. It's more about a purified state of consciousness, where you're at the level or into the above, as the alchemist would say, and as the Emerald Tablet teaches, that you can project that energy, fashion it with the light of your purified, focused thoughts into a reality, either a situation, and the alchemists believe that this could also be materialized in reality. The philosopher's stone can be interpreted and has been as a state of consciousness simply that changes reality by thought, and it's not something that's secret. I think it's something that can be learned by everyone. I think it's been expressed on the planet before in different advanced individuals and avatars and gurus in different traditions. But what's great about alchemy is the way it ties together all these traditions into a kind of a common language. You can find terms for philosopher's stone and for the magic of alchemy in all different traditions, east and west.
And I think that's what Teresa was talking about as far as quantum physics. Are you still with us, Teresa?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay. No, did you have something to add to that? Because I think what you were saying about consciousness is very much this key to the philosopher's stone.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, if we can start to learn to harness our consciousness to that degree where we can actually create transformations at the quantum level, that's the key to really creating those transmutations and being able to almost like, you know, learn how to mold the matrix itself that the physical world is based on. And one of those things that has been developed through the ages with alchemy is techniques for how to harness our consciousness, because there's a key that I think is missing in all this idea of the power of intention and the law of attraction and so forth, and that is how coherent is your consciousness? How coherent are your thoughts of what you're trying to attract to you? And unless you've really applied some techniques and some rigor on creating a more coherent state of being and mind within oneself, you're going to have a really hard time truly creating that kind of impact on the world because of the quantum mechanical interaction between your consciousness, whether it's subconscious or, you know, conscious, and the material world you're trying to affect. So alchemical tradition has really created a lot of techniques for harnessing consciousness.
Well, let me ask Dennis about the alchemical tradition, because as I look through like the alchemical galleries and see all these very complex drawings, it's quite a process of focus, and it is that, I mean, but there's specific things that happen when like the green lion, the white lion, the red lion appears. I mean, those weren't just metaphors, they were actually states of matter, weren't they?
Well, absolutely. The alchemists, when they spoke of their, well, in drawings and their symbols and ciphers, they were usually interpreting it on three different levels. On some physical level, in the laboratory, describing the reaction of chemicals in an experiment. And on the mental level, what Teresa was talking about, of getting to that state of purified consciousness where you and the experiment become one, so that it's a unified, very focused type activity. And on the spiritual level, where you're actually bringing down energy and condensing it. And for instance, the green lion you mentioned is a good example. In the laboratory, the green lion is vitriol, which is a wonderful substance that grows on like aging limestone rock. If you go to a quarry or some old building site, you'll often see it. It's a really beautiful greenish-blue, real very thick liquid, just kind of oozing out of the rocks through being exposed to sunlight. And if you touch it, it's acid. It's sulfuric acid. And that green lion has the power to dissolve many, many things. In fact, sulfuric acid was the driving force of the Industrial Revolution. So it was, to the alchemists, the green lion was like liquid fire, and they use it in their transformation. But in the body, if we're talking about the mental level, the green lion represented a kind of a vitriolic anger, a kind of being upset with the status quo, kind of being upset with yourself and your own limitations and wanting to get beyond that. And that's why the green lion was so very important in the mental meditations and purification of consciousness, because it was a way of etching away all the dross that had built up, all the habitual thoughts and thoughts that really weren't genuine. And that was the kind of green lion meditations that the alchemists went through. And on a spiritual level, the green line is the very energetic presence of the divine mind itself coming down into matter, the most purified level of the green line. And when sometimes the alchemist will be talking about the green line and you don't know what level he's talking about or she's talking about, and read the context. And that's the way they work, and that's why it's so difficult often to understand the writings. Depending on what they were doing. They worked on these three levels simultaneously, and that's very difficult for us to understand. And I think it's the key to learning these methods of alchemy and actually working on three levels at once. It could be body, mind, and spirit, a laboratory experiment, something in the physical, something in the mental, and something in the spiritual, to connect all three of these levels, which the alchemists also called sulfur, mercury, and salt, being sulfur being the energetic presence, and salt being the compound or the physical state or the body, and mercury being the light of consciousness itself. So those are three more key words that you can always count on being present in an alchemical experiment. They often talk about the sulfur of this or the mercury of that, and that's exactly what it's referring to. The key there is that sulfur, as I mentioned earlier, is energy. They really didn't have the word for energy, but because of the characteristics of sulfur or brimstone, they associate it with energy. And then salt, of course, is matter mass and body and created things. And mercury is mind. The connection between the two, the mid-level, the between the alchemist himself, his own consciousness and his body, being able to transform things. So what we've got there is energy, matter, and light, really, and it's the same thing in the universal equation, E equals MC squared. It's kind of that the alchemist sensed that that was the basic triplicity of the universe, that that was the basic, what they call the tree of prima, or the embedded three principles that are used everywhere. So you try to access those principles in alchemical meditation.
Oh, and this is where the idea of Hermes Trismegistus comes in, the Hermes who mastered those three levels of existence. Isn't that
exactly
true?
Exactly, Christ's greatest Hermes in the Emerald Tablet. Yeah. He wrote the Emerald Tablet, and you can pick these out in the Emerald Tablet. Like I said, every alchemist had an interpretation of the tablet from Isaac Newton all the way back to Menelaus from ancient Egypt. They all had their own interpretation and their own use for the Emerald Tablet, and it was usually interpreted on three levels, as some type of physical process, and a mental process, and a spiritual process.
But people have, there were great alchemists who have reached the mastery of these three levels, right, and have achieved, I would say, a level of enlightenment because of this process.
Absolutely, and that is what the Emerald Tablet calls the pattern of the universe, or the hidden pattern that's revealed in alchemy and what is passed down in alchemy. And it's a pattern of transformation that can be seen all around us. It's usually considered to be a seven-step process, and there's analogies all over the place in alchemy. The planetary correspondences that start with Saturn and progress towards the Sun, Saturn being lead, and then Jupiter being tin, Mars being iron, Venus copper, and then Mercury, of course, quicksilver, and the Sun and Moon, finally, the final stages, silver and gold. So when they talk of planetary correspondences, they actually are talking about the metallic correspondences, and they're actually talking about the human temperament, the correspondences of the metals that are in us. Our copper, which is our loving, communicative spirit, and our iron, which is our aggressive or masculine component, or our rationality, if you will. And then there's the leaden part of us that doesn't want to change, that is habitual in darkness, and the explosion of Jupiter energies into a more social presence and a more sexual presence in the world. So each one of these things has these meanings that you arrive at. If you don't have oral teachings or conferences to go to, you pick these up in the drawings, and you meditate on these drawings. The Latin phrase, ora et labora, is exactly how the alchemists work. You know, pray, meditate, and work physically, do the work physically.
Because there's a lot of allusions in those drawings to the sun and the moon and water and fire, and there's something about a direct connection to nature in, you know, it's not just about meditating on the drawings, but somehow it seems like the alchemist is compelled to be in nature as part of his process of transformation.
You are so right. I mean, really hit the nail on the head there, because there was an absolute connection between alchemy and nature. And in fact, that goes back to the origins of alchemy, the origins of mankind, really. When we were in nature, we were totally connected to nature. We were part of nature. And what that consisted of was all natural things, trees and soil and plants and animals, and what made the difference, where the origins of alchemy came from, was when man discovered the metals, discovered that hidden in all these blasé-looking rocks everywhere were magical compounds that they, through their craft and through following the same seven steps we're talking about, could refine these ores and bring them out of the stones, and that became a secret craft, and right there was the origin of alchemy. And the alchemists always go back to nature to learn the lessons in nature, whether they're working with plants, whether they're working with the metals, and whether they're working with themselves. And there's a very much a silent connection that's hard to describe with nature. I sometimes wonder if being in nature is what the oral teachings are all about. The unspeakable part of alchemy is communion.
Well, it is, I think, because, I mean, it is part of nature. But when you said metal, something clicked for me in the sense that metal is a man's ability to extract nature as a tool. And what do you think happened to the consciousness of man when they discovered the use of metals? Because something seemed to have shifted and a maturing of man's ability to use nature at that point.
Exactly, and we can really tie in all the things we've been talking about to that moment in time when man discovered the metals, because the metals, like nothing else on this planet, have transformed it. You know, imagine being in a world without metals. And that is exactly the period when the metals were discovered in time that the legend of the Emerald Tablet originates. That it was actually like a gift, that some texts even say it fell from the heavens, or it came into mankind's possession on how to extract the essences of matter, which were the metals to the alchemists, and how to work with those essences and look for the essences in themselves, in nature and in spirit.
But so, what do you think shifted in the consciousness? I mean, so man was thinking one way, and then they discovered this metal. What was the change in the way we related to the world? What was that?
Is that we were no longer part of nature, but we could actually control nature. We weren't at the whims of nature anymore, but there were parts of nature that we could control. And right there you have the essence of science being originated, and also the origins of civilization and all that, and our relationships to the metals. It all originated with that idea that there were things that man could do, that there were crafts and tools that man could use to transform the planet. And, I mean, it started with the Iron Age and Bronze Age, and we went through these ages, which are very much related to the type of consciousness that was on the planet at the time. And right now the alchemists would say that we're kind of in the Copper Age. We're finally leaving the Iron Age of aggression all over the planet, and there were prophecies from Hermes himself about this, that we would go through these stages, and that the Iron Age would be a warring period full of masculine consciousness, whereas the dawning of the Copper Age, which is related to the procession of the equinoxes in 2012 and all these ideas too, is that this new age, or this new metallic archetype that comes into expression on the planet, as copper has. Copper is the basis of the internet and communications.
The coppers that wire the planet are
The whole world is wired, and it's wired
with copper.
Copper is changing the planet now. And we can help that process by becoming more copper, by recognizing copper. And that's what's happening. I think you can see it in movements like the Alchemy Conference and the Modern Mystery School and the Alchemy Guild and all these many, many groups that are spiritually orientated and want to spread their teachings, as opposed to the groups that want to keep their teachings secret. That spreading the teachings as copper, wanting to hold them secret as a weapon or as a power of their own, that is iron. So that transition is taking place too, and I just hope it continues.
What planet is associated with copper?
Venus. And
so it's love.
It's very much a feminine type of consciousness, but it's different from the moon. The moon is kind of a higher feminine presence. Venus is a down-to-earth, prolific type presence that gives birth to many different metals. In fact, the alchemist called copper the harlot of the metals, because it forms compounds with just about any metal that came its way.
Because we just have to wrap up. Is this your personal practice as a spiritual practice, being an alchemist?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, working with the metals on all levels. I purify metals in the lab and in myself, and on the spiritual level too. And of course, the goal is gold, and that golden state is the philosopher's stone, and really that level is where it all comes together.
Yeah, let's do another show at some point about alchemy and the whole history. This is fascinating. Teresa, are you still with us?
I am. I've just been, fascinated by the conversation and listening to it all. So you are a great interviewer, Alan, and a very engaging host. So
Well, thank you both. This, I mean, it's a subject I've been really interested in, and to me, actual practicing alchemists is very exciting. So tell us just a little bit about the conference before we sign off. Teresa, you want to, or Dennis?
Sure. So the conference is happening at the Los Angeles Convention Center, October 23rd through 25th. And our theme this year is a world of transformation, you know, creating change through alchemy in the many different aspects of life. It's going to be the biggest gathering of alchemists that's open to the public in over 500 years. And we've got just a fantastic lineup of speakers and activities and entertainment and exhibits and all kinds of opportunities to come and explore. And, you know, the exhibit area is free and open to anybody to come and check out. And then with the talks, people can come either just for a single, like a keynote speaker, or just a workshop, or they can come for a whole day, or they can come for 3 days. And there's different pricing based on, you know, how much they want to participate in. So there's something there for everybody. And we're really looking forward to creating just a synergistic coming together of many different minds and people and modalities and so forth to bring alchemy back to the public.
So it's very exciting, and Dennis will be there as well. Do you have anything to say, Dennis, before we...
No, I'm looking forward to the conference. I've been working on these conferences for 3 years now, and they're growing more and more. My colleagues from all over the world are coming and joining us, and Teresa's really been helpful and instrumental, in fact, in expanding the idea of what alchemy is and bringing it out into the world more, more and more copper. So it's a copper gold event, and I wouldn't miss it if I had to crawl to it. Really, it's going to be great.
Well, that's exciting. So the website is alchemyconference.com, and I've been talking to Dennis William Houck and Teresa Ibis. Actually, Ibis was Thoth who brought the emerald tablets to Egypt, wasn't it?
That is correct.
Right. But thank you both for being a guest here on New Realities. And if you want to reach me, my name is Alan Steinfeld, and I can be reached at newrealities@earthlink.net or check my website, newrealities.com. Thank you for listening, and thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alan.
Okay. Yeah.